Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg ad-free and right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
It's 3 o'clock somewhere. Time for a My Mochi ice cream snack. My Mochi ice cream is cool, creamy scoops of premium ice cream wrapped in sweet, pillowy dough. And get this, all of My Mochi's fabulous flavors like strawberry, mango, double chocolate, and cookies and cream are only around 80 calories per piece. Talk about a guilt-free, indulgent experience. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned, gluten-free mochis that are great for grab-and-go. So feel good while curbing your afternoon cravings or the midnight munchies. Yeah, you know who you are with the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream. Find My Mochi ice cream at Target or visit MyMochi.com to locate a grocery store near you.
This is the Ion Travel Podcast with CBS News travel editor Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to another edition of the Ion Travel Podcast, this time from the Seine River as we head from Paris to the heart of Normandy on this historic and eye-opening trip aboard the Viking longship Radgrid. And we'll touch base with author Alec Lebrano. He's written some of the great food books of France, My Place at the Table, Hungry for France, among others. He'll have the latest on the food scene in a country that continues to outdo itself. We'll stop by Versailles and talk with curator Bertrand Rondeau on the enduring legacy of royalty, architecture, and design that still defines Versailles. Then it's back on the river to Rouen, the home of so many Impressionists, and a chat with Michael Dodds, who traces Normandy's history back to the Vikings. As we approach the 80th anniversary of D-Day, we'll stop at the American Cemetery in Normandy to speak with Scott Desjardins, the longtime superintendent of the cemetery, and we'll try to put all of the 9,387 graves into proper historical and, of course, emotional perspective. First up, Alec Lebrano.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Alexander Lebrano, hello, sir.
Hello, Peter.
So, you know, the food scene here is always amazing. I cannot find, I'm sure you can, I just haven't found a bad French restaurant. And, of course, where we're going on this trip is even more amazing when I consider, you know, and you might have a different opinion, but, you know, when somebody mentions Normandy to me, to almost everybody says, oh, D-Day, June 6, 1944. I get that. But Normandy to me means something else too. It means the best butter. And if you go to Brittany, the best oysters. And, you know, it's one thing to say you're on a Viking longship doing the, you know, doing this river cruise, but we're going to have a lot of food.
I think you guys are going to eat. I've done the trip that you're about to to start on. I think Viking is they really do the best river cruises in Europe. I've been on lots of them. I love Viking. And I've done that cruise. You couldn't be going at a prettier time of the year. I think it's really one of the great waterway trips in France. And before you leave Paris, I don't know how much, if you have a night or two there before or after your trip, there are two places I want to tell you about. So I agree with you that the restaurant scene in Paris post-COVID is just, it's boiling or bubbling away, and it's a really delicious time, as always, to be coming to France with an appetite. But there are two people I really want to call out because the Michelin Guide was just released a week ago for 2024, and they're two very talented young women who won their first Michelin stars. There's a brilliant young woman named Manon Fleury, which is a very pretty name, and she merits the name. And her restaurant is called Datil, D-A-T-I-L, and she's in the Marais. Her food is, what she's doing there is she puts fruit and vegetables first, and she uses seafood as a garnish. Her food is healthy, but what's exciting about it is that, you know, I mean, healthy, we all know we should be doing, but I don't want to sacrifice pleasure. I'm a little greedy at the table, and I think any sane person is. And Manon Fleury makes this gorgeous, healthy food that also happens to be stunningly delicious. So that's that D-A-T-I-L. The other one, Peter, I want to send you to, is not hard to remember. It's the headline table at the Hotel Ritz in Paris. That's Eugénie Béziat, and her backstory is fascinating. She's born of French parents but grew up in West Africa. And so her childhood palate is all African foods and recipes. And she just won a star at Les Badons for her very succulent, delicious, poignant, and very beautiful, beautiful cooking. So those are two places you want to get to in Paris before or after your trip. And now I think we want to start moving up river, don't we?
We do. Well, let's move.
Well, okay. Well, away we go. There's something else I want to point out. I don't know if you're going to have any time in, because, of course, this is the year we're celebrating the 150th birthday of Impressionism this year. And there's a fun thing in Honfleur, or just outside of Honfleur, at where the Impressionists painted there. You know, there's a lot of them all grouped at the mouth of the Seine. There was the light and everything else that they loved so much. And at La Ferme Saint-Simeon, outside of Honfleur, was where a lot of the Impressionist painters came and stayed. They didn't have any money. They paid their bills with paintings to the wise old innkeeper who kept them fed. And they're doing a menu this year. It's an Impressionist menu. It's based on what they would actually have been eating at that point in time and serving in their kitchen. A lot of local Normandy foods, of course, some of the world's best cheese, Camembert and Le Verrou, and the other cheeses that are made in Normandy. But also Normandy has a really rich larder, and there's delicious chicken, gorgeous seafood, all kinds of things. And I've looked at that menu, and anybody, I'm going to be in Honfleur in a few weeks, and I'm looking forward to trying the menu. It's just a lot of fun. It's an interesting idea to be able to actually enter into the world of the Impressionists by having a meal.
So what you're saying, what you're saying, Alex, is I could go get Monet's favorite club sandwich.
Well, you're translating into a slightly more feet on the ground version, Peter. But yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
You know, you mentioned, Alex, about the paintings that were being used as currency so people could eat. There's a very famous story that doesn't happen in France, but I love it, so I'm going to share it. Caravaggio, the famous painter, was wanted for murder, and everybody was chasing him. And he sought refuge inside St. John's Co-Cathedral in Malta. And he said, if you'll protect me from the authorities who want to arrest me for murder, I'll paint you a painting. And the church said, great, you have a deal. So he painted an amazing painting. It took him about 3 to 4 weeks to do it, but it was an amazing piece of art. And he presented it to the church. They hung it on the wall, and then they turned him over to the authorities.
So I guess the moral of the story there is to get it in writing. Yeah. I've seen that painting too, Peter. That is absolutely magnificent. But as you're going down the river, going down the Seine to Le Havre, which is another very interesting town. There's great food in Le Havre too, and one of the best museums in France. I mean, outside of Paris, Le Havre has the Musée André Malraux has the largest collection of Impressionist paintings in France. And it's an interesting town. At first look, it's a little hard to understand, but it was completely pulverized at the end of World War II and rebuilt in a huge hurry because they had to house 150,000 people. And now the post-war, for a long time, it looked kind of jagged under low pewter skies in Normandy. But the city has taken on sort of a funky charm, a mid-century charm. I'll be interested. I hope you'll have some time there because it's a very, very interesting city that a lot of people overlook when they're visiting Normandy. I mean, everybody goes to Honfleur because it's gorgeous. And the battlefields, the Normandy landing beaches and the cemeteries are, for an American, I mean, there's no way really it's something that everybody should do during the trip to France.
I totally agree with you because this will be my second trip to the American cemetery in Normandy. The last time I was there, we actually broadcast from there with David Eisenhower, the grandson of Dwight Eisenhower, and who of course is a historian, and he and I walked the graves, and he told the stories, and it's an indelible impression that you will never forget, because when you look at the gravestones of crosses or stars of David, and you take a look at, they don't tell the story of the person who died, but they tell you their age and their rank, and
right.
What you realize, with very few exceptions, is how young they were all. They were so young, you know. They were 19 and 20 and 21, and that their lives ended, within yards of where I was standing.
Did you get to the museum in Avranches, Peter, when you were out there? That museum, which it's very anthropological, but what they do in that museum is they recreate the lives of the young soldiers who actually were coming onto the beach. They recovered a lot of stuff that was left behind after many of them were killed. It's one of the most, I mean, it's hard to go out to leave that museum dry-eyed because, as you say, a lot of those young men, coming from the middle of, from Missouri or wherever they were coming from, had never even seen the sea before they ended up being shipped across the country and put on boats to come and fight in Europe.
Exactly.
You know, they were so young. And
by the way, if there's one lesson, an overriding lesson that I've learned from June 6th, 1944, D-Day at Normandy, and I use it to this day, it's, and I'm not doing it in a flip or cavalier way, I really believe it, it's really not a good idea to be in the first wave. Because when you see the utter destruction and death that happened on that beach, you'll never forget it. But I've got to ask you this, Alexander. We're not that far away from the Olympics this year. That'll be right here in France, in Paris. We've already seen hotel rates up to like $3,000 a night. We've seen Airbnbs that would normally rent for $300 a night going for $1,500 a night. They've raised the cost of the metro. They've raised the admission price at the Louvre. If I were me, and by the way, I am me, and if I were you, I think, and you are you, I'm not going to be in Paris during the Olympics. Are you?
No, I'm not going to be in Paris during the Olympics. I could really let it rip on the Olympics. I think the city of Paris is doing its best to, create a great show, put on a good show, and sponsor the games well. I just find the ticket prices and everything surrounding the Olympics a little far from the original spirit of celebrating sport. For anyone who is going to be in Paris, however, because I do have friends who are coming to the Games, what I've been telling them, Peter, is that, the hotel prices within the beltway that surrounds Paris, the French call it the périphérique, they've gone through the roof. Look at a map of Paris and look at the suburbs that are on the other side of that beltway. Because by staying in Clichy rather than Paris, it's a question of 25 feet. But you're staying in Clichy. There's a great new hotel that's just opened in Clichy at the Porte de Clichy called the Voco. It's an incredibly convenient hotel because it's right near the number 14 metro line. So you can scoot into Paris without any trouble. If you look on the other side of the Périphérique, you can find good hotel bargains. And the same thing is true of restaurants. I think the restaurants are going to be mobbed in Paris this summer. For two reasons, because I think a lot of restaurants are going to close down. A lot of people are wondering whether or not this is really a good time for them to stay open. I think that many business owners and restaurant people have decided to close during the Olympics and have that be their annual vacation. So if you look in a neighborhood like Clichy, which is well served by public transit, there's an absolutely delightful little bistro that I was at in Clichy recently called Rosette. It's run by a young couple from Lyon. And it reminded me of the French food that made me fall in love with French food when I came to Paris for the first time in 1972. Hearty, delicious, just exploding with flavor, made with beautiful produce. And the young woman, the husband's in the kitchen and the wife is the sommelier and runs the dining room. It's a place you'd want to go every day if you lived up in the neighborhood, just because they're so lovely. And it's like being invited to a party. Everybody's having such a good time in that place. Again, that place is called Rosette. And I'd look for other places like that in restaurants that are on the other side of the beltway and or in outlying districts of Paris. I mean, it's a lot of people still stick to the center of Paris. But if you go up into the 18th and 19th arrondissements in eastern Paris, there's fantastic food. It's really good value for money. One of my favorite places up there is called the Cadoret, C-A-D-O-R-E-T. And that's run by a brother-sister team. Their food is absolutely delicious. It's market cooking, fresh market-driven cooking. The menu changes every day. Yeah, get out of the center of the city. Don't stay in the center of Paris. I
agree with you. And, it reminds me of 40 years ago, the Olympics in Los Angeles in 1984. I'm living in Los Angeles. Everybody's panicking that we're going to be overrun by the world. And so many people who lived in Los Angeles left, and I stayed, and it turned out to be the best experience I ever had. The freeways were empty. There was no traffic. There was no rush hour. And for a period of about 2 weeks, L.A. reverted back to the 1930s. And then, of course, the Olympics left, and we all know what happened after that. You can't drive anywhere in L.A. anymore. But that may happen here in Paris as well, but Alex's advice is a good one, and that's use public transit and stay out of town. And only come into town if you're trying to get to a restaurant, maybe, or maybe you're going to the games. But you don't want to stay in town unless you have a huge bank account, because those rooms are going at like $2,500 to $3,000 a night.
Yeah, it's just eye-watering, and that's also, as I say, for the restaurants. Here's the rule of thumb: if you're going to be in Paris for the games. Paris is divided up into 20 arrondissements, which are different districts or neighborhoods. The ones where you're going to have a chance of getting a table more easily are stay away from 1 to 10, look in 10 to 20. And the 10th to 20th arrondissements are the ones that are more outlying. They're also mostly younger, and the prices are a little bit lower. So, make your reservations as far in advance as possible, too.
Absolutely.
A lot of Paris restaurants now do have reservation capacity on their websites, so you can do the booking before you get over here. I'd say to people, make a plan and have it all booked.
My thanks to Alec. Until you see Versailles in person, Everything you've ever read about it seems either exaggerated or, on the other hand, insignificant. But up close and personal, it's a breathtaking experience. Curator Bertrand Rondeau has a tough task to find and restore so many pieces, and at the same time, to find a way to put it all in context. Joining me now is Bertrand Rondeau, who is the chief curator here at Versailles.
Yes, good afternoon.
So the question for you is, of course, as I walk around with you and see all the rooms, it's amazing the restoration work that's done, because this palace, and I can call it a palace, it wasn't originally a palace, but it goes back to essentially a hunting lodge back in what year?
Exactly. It was built in the 1620s. Actually, last year we celebrated the 400 years of the palace, which was built by Louis XIII, the father of Louis XIV, in 1623. But as you said, as a small hunting lodge, not as a palace.
But then it was the other Louis, if you will, the 14th, the 15th, and the 16th, that turned it into the glorification of monarchy and royalty.
Especially because it became the seat of the monarchy, of the French monarchy, in the early 1680s, when Louis XIV decided to move the government and the court from Paris to Versailles. So after that, it had to enlarge to the present size.
And if I've done my history correctly, this was the seat of government for 107 years until a small little incident in 1789, otherwise known as the French Revolution.
Yes, the French Revolution was mainly not in Versailles, but in Paris. But even though at some point the palace was hit by the revolution, when a mob invaded the palace during the night between the 5th and the 6th of October 1789, so a few weeks after the 14th of July, the storming of the Bastille, and in the morning, the 6th of October, the mob forced the royal family to move back to Paris and settle in the Tuileries Palace.
But luckily, as opposed to so many other symbols of royalty, this place did not burn down.
Yes, thank God. Even though some people wanted to destroy the palace totally, it was not done. But unfortunately, the whole content was removed from the palace. The works of art, the collections, were moved to Paris, mainly to the Louvre, the new museum, whereas the furniture was sold at auction.
So the furniture that's here today is what?
So now we're trying to refurnish these apartments, but we have to go back from scratch because we had a few decades ago, I should say, an empty palace. So year after year, we are trying to get back as many pieces as possible through auction sales, through purchasing or gifts from donors and so on. So it's a painstaking and but very successful, I have to say, work done by all the generations of curators here.
And, of course, the artwork has been returned.
The artworks have been returned, mainly from the Louvre, it's true. And so we have now in the main rooms of the palace, the state apartments, the queen's apartment, some amazing works of art and pieces of furniture.
I know it's tough to give me a complete and detailed number, but approximately how many rooms are we talking about here?
If I'm not wrong, today we have about 2,000 rooms. But
say that again.
2,000, but
I don't want to have the cleaning bill.
I'm not doing it myself, thank God. But it's much less than what it used to be, because in the 19th century, King Louis-Philippe in the 1830s turned the palace into a museum. So he destroyed many apartments, creating huge galleries to display the paintings and sculptures of the museum.
And of course, as I walk around with you, I'm amazed by the detail work, also by the gold leaf.
Yes, it's a royal palace, so the gold leaf is used as a decor, but mainly as a symbol, as a royal symbol, a symbol of the quality of the achievement of the artwork, the craftsmen here in France, in Versailles, and also to give more light to the rooms. We have always to remember that effect of gold leaves on boiserie, on wainscoting.
And of course, as I look around, you see not just the gold leaf, but the tile work, the woodwork. Was there any estimate at all about how much money was spent to first build this?
I can tell you, some lists have been made of the spending for the building of the palace at the time, mainly of Louis XIV. And during the peak year of the work, of the construction work here, it was a quarter of the state budget. So it's huge, but of course you have to understand that it was in at the time when there was peace in Europe. So there was not so much to be spent on war, on the armies, thank God.
So what you're basically saying to me is they had an unlimited budget at that time and they exceeded it.
I don't know if they exceeded it, but they used it and for the best, because now we have this magnificent palace, which is a world attraction.
What's the significance of this building today?
I think the significance hasn't changed since it was built. It was turned into a royal palace, an official palace, because it's still one of the seats of the French government, of the Republic, I should say, because it's here where what we call the Parliament meets. That is to say, the two assemblies, the Senate and the Assemblée Nationale, meet when they need to change the constitution, for example. Because here was built in the 19th century a huge space, a huge audience hall, to be able to gather all the members of the both assemblies.
Of course, then there was the Treaty of Versailles.
And the Treaty of Versailles was signed here in 1919 at the end of the First World War against Germany. It was signed here in the Hall of Mirrors because the birth of the German Empire was set here by the proclamation of the Empire in January 1871, at the time when France was occupied by the Prussian armies.
Now, you talk about the Hall of Mirrors. There have been some state functions here, some very big state functions here with other visiting heads of state.
Yes. Versailles is used from time to time for state functions by the presidency. And recently we had the state dinner in honor of King Charles III of Great Britain. So it's a very important moment for the Palace of Versailles because it really means that we are still part of French history and not only a museum.
And you're still making history.
And I hope we're still making history by welcoming these very important meetings or dinners or congresses.
As I walked up the hill, and I should say to everybody, the very first time I came here was with my parents when I was 12 years old, so it's nice to be back. But I remembered when I first came here, and I remembered it today, as you walk up the hill, the chapel to the right is higher than all the other buildings.
Yes, it's the highest building in Versailles, and it had to be, it has to be, because this is the religious place. And as you know, the King of France is a Catholic king. He was called a very Christian king, and he had to attend Mass every day. So the chapel is a very important part of the building, especially because these Masses were public, and anyone could come and attend the Mass and see, therefore, the king, the queen, and the royal family. So it was also an attraction in its own right.
Is it still performing Masses?
Yes, the chapel is still used once a month. There is a Mass once a month. Otherwise, it's used for concerts mainly.
Now, as you and I have walked through so many of the rooms already, we see fireplaces, but none of them are usable anymore. I think that's a good idea because you don't want the place to burn down. But what I noticed in one palace in Austria, which was Schönbrunn Palace, is the unique way they heated it, right? From the basement through these pipes coming into each room at the corners. How was this place heated?
It was not as convenient as it was done in Schönbrunn in Vienna. Here we are more backward, I should say, in France, because we used at the time mainly fireplaces, which were not very efficient. And we used sometimes stoves, but mainly in bathrooms. So we have a few stoves here in Versailles, but never in the main rooms as was done in Northern or Eastern Europe.
Now, I have to ask the elephant in the room question. We see over-tourism throughout the world right now, whether it's in Barcelona or Venice or Amsterdam or Athens. You have challenges here at Versailles because so many people come. How are you managing that?
Yes, it's a big challenge for us, especially because the figures are so high. We have about 5 million visitors a year in the palace. And obviously, the palace was not built to accommodate so many people. When you mention 30,000 people a day in the palace, it's far too much. So now we're trying to limit it and to reduce it by booking in advance the entrance ticket with a timetable, a time slot. But on the other hand, we are one of the most famous places in the world. And with this tourism coming from all over the world, it's difficult to stop the people from coming. But we are wondering how is their experience when they visit if it's too crowded.
My idea of a museum is when I have enough time to stop, to contemplate, to think, and to take it all in and not rush from room to room to room. That's a challenge here.
Yes, it's a challenge because you are pushed by the crowd from one room to the next one and not being able to really stay back and admire whatever.
So I have a solution. Start the tour at 6 in the morning, And then the people who will come will actually have a chance to see it without the crowd.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I think we should enlarge our time opening during the day. And also, but the other solution is to come in January, in mid-January, when there are very few visitors. So this is the best time to come to Versailles. I would recommend all our visitors from the United States to come at that time of the year.
And just dress more warmly.
Yes, exactly.
We're talking Bertrand Rondeau, one of the chief curators here at Versailles. One last question. For all the people who come in here, or even for you, what's the biggest surprise of this place for you?
I think the biggest surprise is the size of it. You may not realize it when you sit from on the city side, from the courtyards, but it's when you reach the gardens and you turn back to the main facade of the palace, which stretches for more than 600 meters. And it's just an amazing view that you cannot forget. And actually, that's the view for the Olympic Games venue, for equestrian venue, that will be seen in a distance, because Versailles is one of the main venues for these Olympic Games 24.
My thanks to Bertrand. Michael Dodge knows the heart of Normandy and Rouen. He's lived it and knows its real significance and the real surprises. It's not just about the Impressionists.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Michael Dodge, how are you, sir?
Hello, Peter.
So when I talk about the history of this capital, most people, when they think of Normandy, just think D-Day. And you and I will talk about D-Day in a second, but you got to stop here first.
You've got to stop in Rouen, and you've got to understand the history, and you've got to understand that it goes back to the Vikings who landed in this area, that came, the men who came from the north, Normandy, people who came from the lands from the north. And they settled in and around Rouen area, and then moved on up further west and enjoyed themselves and decided that they were going to stay, and decided to negotiate in the way they know how to negotiate in those days with the French king to actually set up their own area and get official recognition for it.
So, and they did.
And they were a fairly pioneering bunch that later became absolute. They were like the sort of champions of warfare at the time, and ended up being very, very successful mercenaries in Europe and organizing a very successful conquest of a certain area we know as the United Kingdom today.
Yeah, well, let's not forget that. But they based right here.
This was their original capital, if you can call it a capital. Today, the actual notion of capital is disputed between Rouen and the city of Caen, which is where I live. And then just a bit further upriver, you have Le Havre. So we've got three big cities in Normandy sort of vying for sort of capital status.
And they're all connected by the river.
And they're all connected by the river. The Seine River is obviously a strategic gateway for the whole of France. I mean, it connects Paris as well with the rest of the world. And Normandy is a region of great strategic importance today as well.
You know, if you take a look at certain regions of the world, let's say Malta, everybody came through there, right? Poland, everybody attacked Poland. What happened here?
Well, here, I mean, Paris became established as the French capital, and obviously the Seine was the main means of getting there, and therefore Rouen was an important hinterland port, Le Havre was the main port of access, and it's always been the case, and it's always been an area to defend and develop, and a gateway to the rest of the world. But this Norman heritage and this medieval period, what you have to realise is that from the 11th to the 13th century, there was almost a Norman civilization that actually didn't just stay in Normandy and actually moved across Europe and had great influence in England and in Ireland a bit later on. They conquered half of the south of Italy. They established a kingdom in Sicily as well. So they, in many ways, they were the first Europeans.
Well, that would be their defense.
Absolutely.
But this is a city that has staunchly maintained its history.
It has maintained its history. And you just, as soon as you park your car here and start walking around, the whole area is, you're in a medieval town and city that has, you know, kept that medieval fabric from the word go. And they've spent an enormous amount of energy and effort in restoring all the churches, all the historic buildings. And it's very, very impressive.
And you have to walk. This is a city where if you don't walk, you're going to miss everything. You need to take your time.
I think that's right. I think you've got to park the car, get rid of the car, and just spend time just waltzing around at your own pace with lovely little bistros in every corner, which make it really, you know, fabulous. But it's fantastic for the general atmosphere, the historic sites to visit. Shopping's great here too. Fantastic restaurants. Here you've got the best boulangeries, the best.
Okay, I have to ask you this question because there's a battle going on, right? Who's got the best butter, Brittany or Normandy?
That's a tough question because I used to work for Brittany beforehand, and I know my friends in Brittany would kill me if they said that it wasn't best in Brittany. But hey, it's a culture that's shared between the two regions. Salted butter.
You're getting political now.
Salted butter. That's right. But no, butter's part of the cuisine here too, that's for sure. And
who's got the best oysters?
That's got to
be Brittany, come on.
I think the oysters in Brittany are terrific. Perhaps the scallops in Normandy are even better.
You're covering your bases.
I am.
And yet I've got to ask you, since we go back to medieval days, is there still a moat?
There are traces of that. You have to look a bit harder for that, but it's well interpreted. But in the different museums, all the medieval stories are properly told. And you don't have to look too far to see ramparts. You don't have to look too far to see traces of this medieval history. It's pretty well everywhere.
For people who've never been here, what's the biggest surprise?
The biggest surprise? That's a tough one because it does have a reputation for its medieval history, and it does have a reputation for being a port. I think it's the Impressionist Painters Festival and seeing the quality of the different exhibitions that are presented. But Philip Platel has also made sure that there's a big contemporary twist to the Impressionist Painters Festival.
And we're going to talk to him a little bit later.
Exactly, we will. But you can even go on the ice rink there at the moment and make your own digital artwork whilst skating at the same time. That's a surprise for you.
Well, I can't skate and do anything at the same time. I fall down.
No, Rouen is a historic...
That's called performance art.
Well, exactly. And it's a historic city, but it wants to remain contemporary and a fun place. And many people living in Paris are now choosing Rouen as a nice place to settle and live as well, and we're encouraging them.
And, of course, they come on the river.
They come on the river, and, of course, they come on by train as well. You're literally only an hour and 10 minutes from Paris, and that makes it a convenient, handy stop. Where it's a very easy city to get around, and I think that's one of its big plus points. It's got everything, but it remains at a sort of low-key, low-scale, easy access level.
Yeah, when I walk around, I'm not detecting high energy, but that's a plus.
Well, I think that is a plus, and I think that... the hustle and bustle and the bright lights of Paris have their appeal, but for anyone to sort of take their time and enjoy themselves and appreciate the history and appreciate the culture and appreciate the gastronomy without being stressed, without having to reserve a table well in advance, that's where cities in Normandy come into play. Life is easy here and people appreciate the slow life.
So you promise me I don't have to reserve a table in advance?
Well, maybe not on a Friday night or a Saturday night, but any other day of the week, you should have no problem at all.
Michael, when we talk about Normandy, and I said it earlier, you know, most people think about D-Day, but now we really have to think about D-Day. It's the 80th anniversary and what it signifies. And for people who have never been there, I have had the opportunity to go. You know, it's one thing to talk about walking along the streets of Rouen and taking it in and having your quiet moments. All of Normandy is a quiet moment?
Well, I think there'll be a lot of emotion in and around that first week in June this year, as you can imagine, the 80th anniversary. It is astonishing for us to see and understand that there are going to be big groups, probably for the last time, of American, Canadian, British veterans and from other nationalities too, average age 99, 100, 101, making the effort to come out to Normandy, probably for a very last time. And one of their big things is also to meet children from Normandy and pass on how important it was what happened 80 years ago and how it's important to keep the flame of liberty and the desire for peace going.
You know, when you walk in the graveyard there, the American graveyard, I couldn't help notice. In fact, it's inevitable. You cannot avoid it. As you walk from gravestone to gravestone, whether it's the cross or the Star of David, and you look at the name of the person, and then you see when they were born and when they died, they were all so young.
Absolutely, 19, 18, 20 years old. It's difficult to take in and to comprehend. But this is why it's amazing for us to see the veterans come back. And there's going to be, as I said, a lot of emotion. I know all the school children in Normandy, you can imagine the lessons they have at school at the moment, and they're all up for it and looking forward to it. And the interaction between the veterans and the youth is going to be a big moment in June.
Of course, it's not just the graveyard. It's not just Omaha or Juneau or Utah Beach. It's the lessons learned.
It is the lessons learned, and people need to understand not only the heroism of what took place during the Battle of Normandy, but also understand what it meant to the people of Normandy and the city of Normandy. And there will be commemorations not just for the American veterans and the British veterans and the Canadian veterans, but also in memory of the civilian population that suffered. 20,000 civilian victims as well during the Battle of Normandy.
And most people don't know that.
Most people don't know that, and there'll be celebrations as well, not just in June, but throughout the rest of the summer till the end of August and September, celebrating the liberation of each town. That will also take even greater significance this year.
You know, when you read up and you do your history about June 6th, 1944, what you realize is that, and I say this not in a cavalier way, but the lesson that I learned from watching and reading about June 6th, it's not a good idea to be in the first wave.
No, not at all. And it is just incredible the level of sacrifice and commitment that prompted people to be in the first wave, the ever so important first wave that was oh so necessary. But and even when you hear about in this time, you know, 80 years on, we're understanding the global picture even more. We understand the sacrifice of Canadian and British soldiers in Dieppe in 1942, where they did a little test run. That was absolutely catastrophic in terms of the number of casualties.
Because they always knew they had to come here.
Well, they knew they had to at some stage, but it was quite a physical challenge actually landing in a successful way. So there were a few tryouts and a few. I think the sort of, it's not just the sacrifice; it's also the actual physical feat of being able to land and transport thousands of soldiers and all equipment and the rest into the area. It was quite unbelievable what happened.
And if you take a look, when you get to Normandy, and I encourage people listening to the show, if you have a chance, whether it's the 80th anniversary or you get a chance to go anytime, you'll see this when you get there. It's one thing to look out over the water and see the beaches. It's another thing to see the German fortifications that are still there and to see how impossible it was for those troops to get to the beach.
Absolutely. And there are some sites where it's just astonishing. There were sheer cliff drops that were scaled by paratroopers, British paratroopers, American paratroopers. And you wonder, how on earth did they do that? But the key message that we want to get across is don't all come on the 6th of June.
Really?
You can actually come throughout the summer and well into the autumn. There'll be festivities and different commemorative events right until October. And I have to say, there are 97 sites or monuments or museums that are well worth a visit. And throughout Normandy, the actual area of the D-Day landing beaches is quite a big area. You know, it's over 80 square kilometers. And again, there's all the history.
And you're not going to see that in one day, not even close.
You're not going to see that in one day. Of course you're not. Take your time. And you don't have to devote all your holiday to the Second World War theme either. You can dip into the medieval history. You can dip into the gastronomy. You can dip into the... We're a very bike-friendly region as well. We're crisscrossed with all sorts of cycle paths showing beautiful countryside. we want visitors to take their time and not just rush between visiting one or two cemeteries and then moving on to Paris. Take your time, enjoy yourselves, take it all in.
But I think you would agree with me, Michael, that the American cemetery in and of itself is overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. I must have visited Colville American Cemetery about 40 times. I go there with pleasure. Is that the word? Probably not. But it's no problem for me going back there every time. And every time you can't help but be moved.
Can I make a suggestion to my listeners? First of all, come in September. Don't come in June. Number one, the weather's still great. Number two, if you possibly can, I know so many people come by bus, but if there's a way to get there another way and get there at like 6:30 in the morning or get there at 4 in the afternoon, because it's the light that hits in just the right way that tells a whole other story.
I think that's right. And it's just the setting of the Colville Cemetery that sort of then just sort of drifts into the sea at the end. It's just spectacular, fabulous. That the British recently did their own memorial in a similar manner that was opened during COVID. So they got a soft launch. It's at Vaires-sur-Mer, the British memorial. And that's a similar setting, absolutely fabulous, overlooking Gold Beach, and overlooking the Aramanche artificial port, where there are still vestiges of the artificial port they created that secured the D-Day landing beaches.
By the way, speaking of the landing beaches, so many visitors will go to the cemetery and the memorial, but never get out to the beach. And if there's a way to get down there, go down there, because that's when you really can take it in from a different perspective, because now you're not looking down, you're looking up. And that's when you get an idea of how formidable this target was.
That's absolutely right. And you can imagine the sort of discussions there have been in Normandy as to whether the Normans should be allowed to play on those beaches or not, or whether they should just be left as they were 80 years ago.
And your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, some of those sites, there are actual sort of memorials that are actually built onto the beach, which means that people, they actually don't go and play in and around them. But the rest of the beaches, yes, they are used by the Normandy population, and I think all the veterans are completely in agreement with that. They fought for liberty and freedom, and they want people to be able to live their lives, you know, as they would wish, and access to the sea and the beaches is part of that. So, no, it's all very done in a respectful way. But as I was saying, the Normandy youngsters it's a sense of pride, it's a sense of responsibility. But there's generally great excitement about this 80th anniversary.
When I was growing up, my first exposure to D-Day was black and white footage. That's what we saw, newsreel footage. And only in the last 20 years have they uncovered color footage taken of combat during that day. And that changes the entire perspective.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that obviously in Hollywood productions, be it Saving Private Ryan or others, have made sure that that theme won't disappear from the minds of people for many, many years to come. The First World War and the Second World War are still huge world events. Normandy for the Second World War, the number of visitors increases year upon year. You might think that, oh, over a course of time, people would lose interest in this theme. That's not the case. We get outside a big year like this year, we already get about 2 million visitors with that motivation in mind, visit the Normandy landing beaches. It's growing. It is being passed on from generation to generation, as it should do.
And I'm usually not a big fan of gift shops, but I will tell you, when I went to the beach, to Normandy about 2 years ago, I went into the gift shop, and what did I buy? I bought books. I wanted to learn again. And, of course, the old saying is, if you can't remember the past, you're doomed to repeat it. Read the books.
I think that's right. The bookshop at the Mémorial du Corps Museum is probably one of the best bookshops that talks about the 20th century in France or in Europe. And, you've got to read up about this. You've got to understand the importance of what happened. It's Normandy is a reference in world history because of D-Day and the Battle of Normandy. I'm just proud to be working and promoting for a region that has anticipated the best way of commemorating that now. And it's September, we will be hosting for the sixth time our own World Peace Forum. I think that's pretty important in the days we're living at the moment.
My thanks to Michael. Now, if you're going to Normandy, you owe it to yourself to go to the American Cemetery. And on the way, stop at the War Museum in Cannes. built over a once active German bunker. And then you head to the cemetery itself. Every grave tells a story. And as we approach the 80th anniversary of D-Day, I sit down with Scott Desjardins, the superintendent of the American Cemetery. Scott, thank you for letting us talk to you.
It was not a problem. Thank you very much.
You know, I'm always amazed by what I don't know about this cemetery. You know, if we just go by the numbers, and you'll correct me the minute I'm wrong, but there are 9,387 graves here that we know that are marked, right? And when you walk among those graves and you see the crosses and the Jewish stars, and I keep saying this because it's just daunting to me. It's just remarkable when you put yourself back on that day, how young these men were.
Yes, these men were very young. The average age of the service member that's resting here at Normandy was 22 to 23 years old. But keep in mind that it doesn't take many 40 and 60-year-old generals and colonels to die to really skew that number into something that's really hard to understand. I will tell you that the average age of a young infantryman for World War II was 19 and a half years old.
And this really represented, for almost all of them, their very first trip outside the United States.
Absolutely. I'm sure that some of them couldn't have pointed France to you out on a map when you told them they were going to France. But for the bulk of this force that came here, this was their first trip overseas.
And then there are another 1,557 were basically the unknowns.
Yes, it's not the unknowns. It's the people on our wall of the missing. These are service members who died on the field of battles, whose bodies have yet to be found.
And every once in a while, you actually find another American serviceman, and you bring them here.
Yes, a matter of fact, in the last 2 months, we've identified four more unknowns. There are four more rosettes on our wall of the missing. The rosette on the wall of the missing symbolizes, since the wall was engraved with that name, that service member has been found. And the last burial that we had here in Normandy was 2021.
But we need to put all these numbers in proper perspective, because that is not all the people who died here. In fact, I'm talking just the Americans. Give me that number again.
For the Americans themselves, on the 6th of June, it was almost 5,000 people who were deceased.
Right, but in terms of the cemetery here, how many people are not buried here?
62% of the service members who died during the Normandy campaign were repatriated back to America.
So that means if they had all stayed here, this would be three times larger than it is.
Yes, the cemetery would be three times larger than it is today.
And that itself is just hard to even comprehend.
Yeah, there's no point from the cemetery at any angle where you can see all of the 9,387 crosses. So it's a large cemetery.
When you first came here 17 years ago, what was your first impression?
My first impression is this is not a sad place. This is a place that makes you... When I walk into the cemetery, and that's our job every day, my job every day is to make sure that every American who leaves the Normandy American Cemetery is a little prouder to be American, and that every foreigner who leaves the cemetery leaves with a little more respect for what America does for its past service members. So it's an overwhelming place. It makes you think. It makes you understand what sacrifice really meant. And if you look at it in this way, that every single cross out there doesn't only represent a service member, it represents a father, a mother, an uncle, an aunt, a friend, a sister, brother. This war of World War II affected everyone in America.
Of course, for current generations, their first exposure to the cemetery was Saving Private Ryan.
That's absolutely right. Their first exposure was Saving Private Ryan, which is a real story that was really meant for the Nyland brothers. But it did at least open up their eyes. It did make people curious. There's no doubt that our visitation went blew after the Saving Private Ryan. 12 years ago, you didn't have this parking lot. The parking lot's a little parking lot that you see out here, and we would average a couple thousand people a month. And now we're averaging 15 to 16,000 people a day between June and July and August.
Well, the good news about that is the story is being handed down.
Absolutely. We would like everyone to visit the Normandy American Cemetery. I think if you arrive here, even if you have no interest at all, if you're being drugged here by mom and dad, you're going to leave with a different perspective when you get back in that automobile.
And yet this was not the original cemetery.
This was not the original cemetery. This was one of 10 provisionary cemeteries during the war. During the war, we buried men on the fields of battle where they fell very quickly for sanitation purposes. After the war, it was decided that America didn't want several small cemeteries throughout the Normandy our region, and that we were going to close those provisionary cemeteries and bring the bodies back to one central location, that location being here at Colville-sur-Mer, the Normandy American Cemetery.
And yet so many of the people who were buried here, when you take a look out at the ocean and the sea out there, they died within walking distance.
Well, within 100 meters of where they're buried, a lot of them, absolutely.
I mean, that in itself is just staggering.
Yes, I think that another thing about the Normandy American Cemetery is it is next to the beach where the men fell. We have to keep in mind also that before World War II, Bloody Omaha, which is what it's called today, was called the Golden Beaches of France. These were some of the prettiest beaches in France. It's where people from Paris came on vacation. You can imagine the seaside full of bungalows and vacation homes. When the Germans occupied this portion of Normandy during the war, those bungalows were destroyed to give the Germans a clear field of fire. I think it's quite a gift from the Republic of France to have given us one of their prettiest beaches to build a cemetery over, and then to protect it by making laws that make it illegal to build commercial enterprises around it, because that view is very important. It's very telling.
I mean, when you see that beach and how pretty it is, and to realize, I'm assuming nobody goes swimming there.
A lot of people go swimming there.
They do still?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And you would think that's strange. And I've got a guide who tells a story, very moving story, of seeing the tears in a veteran's eyes one day when he saw people on the beach. And as a French guide, she excused herself, said how disrespectful this is of these people. And he said, no, absolutely not. That's exactly why we came, to liberate that beach so the kids could go walk on the beach. So we would think that it's disrespectful, but veterans don't see it that way at all. They accomplished their mission. They gave the kids the beach back that they should have been on before.
Now, of course, you have a huge number of French coming here, huge number of Americans. What about Germans?
We have Germans that come here, but it's a very different group of Germans as opposed to 15 years ago. 15 years ago, when a German visitor came, he almost came with his head down and didn't want you to know he was German. They didn't ask many questions. They were very respectful. It's very different now. The generations have changed. It's younger Germans who are coming with a lot of questions as to what is it that my descendants did, what went on here. So it's a very different type of visitor. But that's for all countries. We have our visitor today, our American visitor, is quite different from the visitor that we had 15 years ago.
In what way?
In what way is that people now are on a quest. I will tell you, 15 years ago, we still had veterans coming. We were coming to see their buddies. We still had spouses of veterans. We had children of veterans. Now we have grandchildren of veterans who come here with questions. What did grandfather do? Because no one told us. What did my uncle do? I heard about him every Christmas and Thanksgiving. We all talked about him, but I don't know what he did. So we've had to change what we do to make ourselves we become teachers. We become people with information.
You become storytellers.
We become storytellers. So the veterans are no longer here to tell their stories. Their spouses are no longer here. Their comrades are disappearing very quickly. So it's up to us to make sure that people understand what it is these people did on the 6th of June, 1944, and to what they did to liberate Europe. So we have changed everything that we do, how we do things, so that we can service our visitors with the information that they need.
Now, you mentioned the Germans that do come, but there's also a German cemetery.
Yes, there's a German cemetery that used to be the American Provisionary Cemetery. The Cemetery of the Calm, which is about 20 minutes from here, is a German cemetery today, very large German cemetery.
More than 20,000 graves.
More than 20,000 graves. It was... Lacombe, where the German cemetery is today, was one of our 10 provisionary cemeteries. We disinterred the American bodies here, brought them to Normandy. And then the French gave the cemetery to the Germans, so where they could bury their war dead. We have close ties with the German cemetery today. We attend their ceremonies. They attend ours. I think it's the process of reconciling and realizing that the war, as a historian and interpreter, nothing offends me more than when I hear a professional tour guide say the Nazis, because only 10% of the German army were Nazis.
Every June 6th, there's a ceremony.
There is.
Without fail.
Yes.
This June 6th marks the 80th anniversary. What's going to be different?
It's a five-year, every five-year anniversary is a huge anniversary. And then every 10-year anniversary is even larger.
I might remember to remind everybody that back on June 6th, 1969, you put a time capsule in,
yes,
right? And it could only be opened up in 2044.
Yes.
So we have a ways to go, another 20 years. But forgetting that, do you know what's in that time capsule?
What we hear in the time capsule is journals from reported from the 6th of June, 1944. I hope that's what's in the capsule. I hope it's in good shape. I hope that they waterproofed it very well.
The problem with most time capsules is they didn't do a good job in doing that.
Right, maybe so. But that's what we understand is in the time capsule. But it's a surprise to us too. We really don't know.
But now this June, what will happen?
This June, we're going to be welcoming 170 World War II veterans, which the number's very huge.
That's remarkably huge, considering the age.
Yes, the average age is from 98 to 103. There's been associations that have worked real hard for several years now to gather these veterans and bring them here on the 6th of June. The importance of this in this June is that these men are aging. This is probably the last time for us to give them a big thank you. Thank them for their sacrifice and service. It will be a bi-national ceremony here. That is, there'll be representatives from the French Republic and some White House representation, along with a large congressional delegation, and we expect 12,000 visitors.
On one day?
In one day, 12,000 visitors for the ceremony.
A rather large parking lot.
But it's something we've done in the past.
When people come here, and I'm sure you see this every single day, what's the biggest surprise to them?
The biggest surprise to them, I think, is the layout of the cemetery, all the white crosses. We have what we call an interpretation threshold. That's to say that when you walk in the cemetery from any entrance, it looks like a park. It looks like a botanical garden. It's beautiful. Then all of a sudden you make a corner and these crosses hit you right in the face. And you can see the change. Even you can see the change on small children. You know, 5-year olds are very excitable.
And they become very quiet.
They become very quiet. And that's when you know they've hit the interpretation threshold. That's when they know they're taking into account what it is that they're looking at. And the sacrifice and how large it was. And that's any visitor from any country, any age. That's what happens. There's a transition there.
Every time I come, I round that corner, and when I see that row of crosses and Jewish stars, I have to stop. You, whatever you're doing, you stop.
Yes, absolutely. It's exactly what the cemetery was built for. It's exactly what we want people to leave with. As I said before at the very beginning, my job is very simple. My goal at the end of the day is that Americans leave here a little prouder to be Americans, and that foreigners leave here with a little more respect for America. And I think it does that very well.
Because one thing you can do is when you put things in geographic perspective and you look at the distances that are either very short or not long as you expect them to be, then it comes screaming home as to what they must have gone through.
Oh, absolutely. When you can see real low tide here in Normandy, Hollywood can't replicate it. Saving Private Ryan, we talked to veterans, were some of the most realistic battle scenes that they've ever seen. And yet I had a veteran tell me that when I asked him, was it really that realistic? And he said, there's never been a film and there should never be a film made on what we went through on the 6th of June, 1944. It was much worse than the opening scenes of Saving Private Ryan.
Well, you talk about those opening scenes. I tell this to people today as my lesson from that movie, as I try to live my life, is not a good idea to be in the first wave.
No, absolutely not. The first wave, we suffered 92% casualties in the first wave, 83% in the second wave. We didn't even start to break even until the fifth or sixth wave. There were thoughts of even stopping this operation and moving everything to Utah Beach. This is how...
Because Omaha is where it really happened.
Yes, Omaha was crucial. The reason Omaha was so crucial is because of the five draws of Omaha. It's the only beach of the five that has five accesses to the National Highway. We need those accesses to support the number of troops that we're bringing to Europe. That's why it's the beach that got two divisions. We knew the highest casualties were going to be on Omaha Beach. That was well known.
And yet, when they got to the beach, they had to get up the cliffs. Yes. And they had to do that hand over hand over hand over hand. basically taking so much enemy fire.
Yes, they had to do that. Keep in mind that when you do an attack, the American strategy for an offensive is you attack at 3-1 odds. These men were never at 3-1 odds. The first wave, we can't bring all the waves in one wave. And so the men are going to be outnumbered all day long until about noon.
And to make matters worse, all the tanks they thought they were going to support them sank.
They say it was a bad idea. The tanks were what we call double D tanks. They were M4 Shermans with special equipment with propellers. It's very difficult to control a 36-ton tank in the water. The idea failed.
Amazing. Lessons learned and hopefully lessons applied.
Yes. The Normandy campaign was won by what we call small unit action. Normandy campaign was not won by a great strategy or generals. It was won by colonels and lieutenants and sergeants and captains who made quick decisions on the battlefield.
My thanks to Scott, to Alec Lebrano, to Bertrand Rondeau, to Michael Dodge, and my thanks to you for listening to this Ion Travel podcast. For more conversations with the world's leaders in travel, as well as answers to your travel questions, be sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And for all the breaking travel news, just log on to petergreenberg.com.
The Ion Travel Podcast is produced by Amanda Morris and Anthony Protis Chung. For more content from Peter Greenberg and the Ion Travel team, visit petergreenberg.com. Ion Travel is a production of CBS News Radio.
If you like Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.